Hi, and welcome to the Soul Awakening Podcast. I'm your host, Kat Fowler, and today we are going to be talking all about yoga. Now, I know that when you hear that word, you probably are starting to think of either going to a class, people in certain brand clothing, the stereotypical stuff that you would see in the West. But what we're going to be talking about really is the path to self-realization today. And that is the eight-limb path of yoga. That is really what true yoga is and it's all about. So for those of you that don't really know where my background in this comes from, my parents actually met in an ashram many, many years ago. And so I was raised in this context of yoga and spirituality my entire life. We lived in a normal house. We didn't live in an ashram. But there was the influence of that spirituality permeating my life every day. We were raised vegetarian, me and my sister as kids. And the philosophy of yoga was really such a huge part of my life growing up. And so naturally, anything that your parents want you to do, you kind of rebel against as a teenager, at least I did. And so I really moved away from that. At the age of 14, I was taught meditation by my family's guru and initiated into that ashram with their specific techniques regarding meditation. These are all mainly from the Bhagavad Gita. So if you read the Gita, you can get some of those on your own. But after that, I went through a little bit of a wild phase and completely moved away from it. And it took me until college to really return back to it on my own. And I always use this phrase, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. And so that was my life. And there was a lot of turmoil in my home. And so, you know, I was really faced against the questions like, if this is the system that can lead to enlightenment and self-realization, then how come I'm seeing so much turmoil in my own home with these people that practice that? Now, I think that was, you know, everything for a purpose, everything for a reason, in my opinion. And so once I really went over that hurdle and I had to really ask myself these questions as, you know, a young adult with now rational thinking mind after the teenage years in college, after a really intense breakup with my first love, so silly now, I was extremely depressed, like very, very sad, didn't want to leave, didn't want to do anything, work out, nothing. And so eventually my mom kept pushing me and said, hey, you know, go take a yoga class, go do a yoga class. So finally I did. And my very first class, I had a clairaudient experience. Clairaudience is when you hear the voice of either your guides, your higher self. It's an inner hearing. It's a psychic gift. We have a bunch of gifts. And some of the previous episodes that I've done with certain guests, that we talk about that. And we'll talk about that also in future episodes as well. I think it's really important because the word gifts, even to me, is a little bit funny because they're not. Like, we all have them. These are our innate senses and abilities. And through society and conditioning, we were taught and we learned to shut them off in order to seem societally normal. But then, you know, comes the larger question, well, who's running these societal programs and why is it normal to turn off these innate gifts that we have that really help us navigate the world spiritually? So to call them gifts, like, I understand why, but really they're these innate abilities that all of us have. They're just dormant until they're, you know, we spiritually really purify ourselves to wake them up. And a huge part of the yoga system, the eight-limb path, which we're going to get into, is turning on those innate abilities. And that comes not, that's not the goal, but that comes as a side, as like a, it's called a boon or a city from dedicated practice. It just happens automatically. And funny enough, in the yoga tradition, we actually believe a lot of these gifts are more of an obstacle than they are a practicality, because it's just another thing that adds to your ego, to which you have to humble yourself from and understand that you're not better than anyone else because your gifts are turned on or your abilities are turned on. So really, we look at these like psychic boons or abilities as really the bigger obstacles. They come further down the line, but this all really opens up through practice. So let me turn this tangent around. So when I took my first class in Shavasana, I had a clairaudient experience, and it was a very clear voice saying, this is what you have to do. You have to teach yoga. And I was at the time at school for psychology. I thought I was going to become a family and marital therapist. And so I was like, okay, I've never had a clairaudient experience, but like that was really strong. And I remember getting in my Jeep and driving back home and after the class, and I literally had to pull over on the side of the road because I almost felt like high. And mind you, I don't do any psychedelic drugs. I never have. So I don't know like what that would compare to really with the psychedelic experiences. I've had my own personal experiences, but it was the first time that that's ever happened to me. And it was through a yoga class. And I think the real reason why that happened was it was really the first time that I was consciously having to guide my breath. There was also the element of a lot of Sanskrit chants that I haven't really heard or spoken in a long time since I was a child. There was all these elements that the perfect blend of a class of really bringing you through this eight limb system as much as the teacher could, that when I left, I was in an altered state in a very positive way. It felt like bliss. It was so moving. I literally had to pull my car over and stop because I was like, I don't know if I should be driving like that. So mind you, then my life path changed and I just knew I had to do that. I didn't know why. I didn't know how. I was broke and in school at the time. And, you know, I was like, okay, let's make this work. So I did. I ended up taking a teacher training that I could afford in New York City and then started working full time pretty much immediately. And from there, then I just saved up and did more and more and more trainings. And I have been teaching for a little over 11 years. So this is what is leading me here. I've taken about 15 trainings, 16 trainings in the yoga tradition, and I have taught several probably since 2000. I want to say 11 was the first time I started teaching on the 200 hours and 300 hour trainings. So within that, some of my main teachers, and especially when it comes to philosophy, was Dharma Mitra. And prior to becoming a yoga teacher, I was practicing yoga with him for many, many years. And the first time I saw him, I cried. It was like seeing almost like a family member that I haven't connected with in a long time. And I hear this happens to a lot of other Dharma yogis. He's amazing. If you guys are in New York City, or even if not, because he offers a lot of classes online on different platforms, take his class. He's currently 80 years old. So if you have the opportunity to, I would absolutely do that soon. And he really ingrained the philosophical aspect of the practice within me. His teachings, just his talks in class, his trainings that I've taken it. And just him living his life as an example is what really I emulated for many, 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 many years, and what really gave me a very solid foundation in the most traditional aspects of yoga. So if you got this far, thank you for listening, because I know this went on a little bit of a personal tangent, but I wanted you to understand where I come from, why I've decided to do this podcast on the eight limbs, and why I think it's so important. So this podcast in particular, the Soul Awakening podcast, is really meant to give you as the listener so many different avenues towards your path, finding your path, your truth towards self-realization or the soul awakening, learning and knowing who you are from the inside. And that's why I bring on tons of different guests from different avenues, like sound healers, Chinese medicine doctors, Buddhists. And I haven't really had any yogis on yet. And so that's why I'd love to do yoga the right justice that it deserves by talking about the path from the spiritual perspective as to what it can give us. And ideally demystify some of the practices that people think are kind of elusive, as well as debunk some of the misconceptions about what yoga really is. So With that also being said, when we start talking about the eight limb path or the eight steps or stages of yoga to lead you towards self-realization, a lot of it is going to be in Sanskrit. So I figured in order to make it understandable, obviously I will translate, but also in the show notes, we're going to have all of the eight limbs and all the Sanskrit terminology as well as the translation written out. So as I'm going along with this, you can also follow along if you feel like, whoa, this is just like a lot of foreign terminology and I don't understand. That's okay. that's kind of how it always is in the very beginning. But so that will all be in the show notes for you to follow along with. Also, I'd like to note that when I teach the eight limbs, in particular in a teacher training setting, that can be about 3 to 4 days long. And these are 9-hour days of learning. So what I'm trying to do is condense this into an hour. And now it's like about 40 minutes being where we are in time. So we're getting the very super abbreviated version, but what I hope this gives you is you can kind of see like, okay, Buddhists follow this kind of path. Someone who follows sound healing, that's their path to God or towards the higher self or towards their soul. And for a lot of people, yoga is the path towards self-realization. So this is me offering that information to you. So let's talk about what yoga really is. So yoga is a set of techniques and practices devoted towards self-realization that you can achieve in this human form on our planet now. Yoga is not a religion, and I really want to stress that it's not, because I know in certain parts of the country and certain different countries in the world, people think it's a religion, and it's definitely not. That's just a way to keep people out from something that can really lead them towards their soul. So it's not a religion, but it's a science. And if practiced correctly, it can bring radiant health and, like I was talking about earlier, a development of your natural psychic gifts. So these then may be used towards the goal of yoga, which is realizing the true self or the higher capital S self within. Yoga is not what you see in a typical yoga class. There are exceptions, but yoga is not just doing the postures in a hot room, getting your sweat on, and leaving. No, absolutely not. Like, that would be the tip of the iceberg, and then underneath, and it's very small on top, and then underneath is a massive, massive system. That is what yoga really is. So I know there's this association where, you know, we talk about yoga and people are like, I don't like yoga for whatever reason. Like, I don't like the music. I don't like the stretching. Yeah, I get that. That's not yoga. Those are postures. That's the posture practice. And I always recommend to the teachers listening and the teachers that I've worked with and the mentees that I've worked with that you really want to try to incorporate these eight limbs in your classes. So it's not just the students coming in, working out, maybe with some breath awareness and leaving, but instead they go through the entire spectrum of the practice. Now, that being said, let's get into the eight limb path. So the eight limbs of yoga comes from Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. You can find that book anywhere. I recommend, if you've never read it, get the pocket version, like a pocket size version, and just go through it slowly. There's a lot of wisdom in there. I'd also like to stress that in the Yoga Sutras, there is, out of the entire book, only one line on the posture practice. Only one. Okay, so you can really get a good perspective of how much the postures are really, how much of the yoga system that really is, because it's been a little distorted here in the West, but we're going to go through the entire eight limbs now. So the Ashtanga yoga system is divided into those eight steps or stages. Ashta in Sanskrit means eight, and Anga is limb, so Ashtanga yoga. And it's not the like same yoga that, you know, celebrities practice. That's also a physical practice of yoga. We're talking about the Sanskrit translation for the name eight limb path. So there's eight stages. So the first one is the yamas. That means the ethical rules. Second one is the niyamas. That's the observances that you should hold. The third one is the asanas. That's just the postures. This is what you typically think of when you go to a class. The fourth limb is pranayama. So pranayama means breath control or control of the prana. Prana means energy or life force, and yama means to restrain or control. So it's control of the breath. Pratyahara is withdrawal of the senses. Dharana is concentration. Dhyana is meditation. So they're different, and we'll get into that. Samadhi is bliss. It's enlightenment. It's nirvana. So this limb system, you could think of it as going from really physical to metaphysical, really gross to really subtle. It slowly gets more and more subtle as you go up in the stages. You turn inwards as you go upwards. The first three limbs are highly physical. The last three limbs are extremely esoteric. The fourth limb, the one in the middle, is the bridge between the two. It's the combination of both. It's almost like similar to our chakra system, how the heart really is that bridge between the upper chakras, the lower, the physical and the spiritual. It's the same thing, but in yoga, it's the breath. It's really the breath work. So just be cognizant of that as we're going up the limbs, that the first ones are, again, more rooted in the physicality of the world, in our earthly being, in how we live our life, how we conduct ourselves as yogis, and then it goes up into the more and more subtle. I'd also like to just preface that my teacher Dharma always says, without yamas and niyamas, there is no yoga. Meaning without the first two limbs as their foundation, you're not practicing yoga. I fully agree with that. You can choose differently, but that is how I live my life. And I, as a yogi, and to those listening, fully agree with that. Like, the prereqs are the first few limbs, and you can go ahead and meditate all you want, but if you're not practicing the yamas and the niyamas, you're not going to get very far. You're going to practice for a very long time with probably very minimal results. Okay, there's exceptions to everything. There's karma, like, yes. But really, I just want to put that out there because I think that's a very important point. Also, when we start talking about the yamas and niyamas, a lot of people say that the very first yama, which is ahimsa, which means nonviolence or non-harming, is the most important yama. And that you can forget all the rest, but if you just practice that one, like, you're good. Like, things will start to work out for you. So that being said, those are the eight limbs. You can take a look at the show notes if you'd like to follow along with the Sanskrit, but I'll be translating and we'll begin. So the yamas and the niyamas, those are the first two. Those are the ethical rules and observances as a yogi. They're just how we should conduct ourselves when we're not in a yoga class, when we're, you know, on the day-to-day basis. So the yamas are ethical restraints. So ahimsa, which is the first one, translates to non-violence or non-harming. So this means in every single facet. This means not only towards ourselves, not harming ourselves, not only towards others, other human beings, not harming other people physically, audibly, with your words, emotionally. This also spans to the animals as well. They are also sentient beings that feel love, they feel pain, they have families. This also extends to them. So in turn, ahimsa also, this is why it's really part of so many ancient books. You can check out the Garuda Samhita, Hatha Yoga Pradipika. There's lots of books that talk about how and why a vegetarian diet is such an important component of practicing ahimsa, of practicing the path of yoga. Now, obviously, those are really old texts. There wasn't factory farming and animal agriculture and animal testing going on back then. So vegetarianism was fine. The cows were treated just fine when they were milked. And now it's like obscene and really heinous, and the amount of harm and violence that is inflicted onto especially the dairy animals is really unheard of. So really now Dharma in particular also really talks about moving towards a vegan diet, because you're just trying to abstain and remove yourself from as much harm as possible. So ahimsa is non-harming. And again, like I said, not only towards yourself, others, and animals, but it's also in every facet. So it's in your thoughts, not having harmful thoughts, in your words, in your actions. It's even in your decisions, in pretty much every way that you live your life. So the second yama is satya, and that means truthfulness or non-lying. So this is truthfulness in your words, and this is truthfulness in your actions, your deeds, and to yourself. I think the biggest thing about waking up is like, yeah, you could be truthful and honest to everybody, but if you're not honest to yourself, the progress isn't going to be as fast as you'd like on the ascension path. So truthfulness in word, action, and deed. Traditionally, they believe really just to maintain silence if the truth is not to be spoken. And if it's harming, use restraint. Ahimsa trumps satya. So ahimsa is the main yama, like the most important part, foundational part of the yogic path. So that is always the first and foremost consideration. Okay, the third yama is called asteya, or not stealing. So desire is the root cause of all theft. And there's many forms of stealing. There's stealing possessions. There's stealing someone's time, someone's space, someone's energy, all of the above. This comes from a lack of realization that we are all one. The goal of yoga is really to merge with the Supreme Self, our higher self, or God, however you want to see it. And then you really do see the oneness. And when there's a separation from source or separation from self, there's also a separation from the others around you. And that's the only way that harming or theft or any of these things can occur. So non-stealing. The fourth one is brahmacharya. So that is restraint or control of your sexual energy. In classic yogic thought, it represents really the life of celibacy taken in order to devote yourself towards spiritual study. Sexual abstinence is prompted by the attitude that one sees divinity everywhere. However, in modern day times, if you are not a monk or a swami or a mahatma or taking that kind of path, brahmacharya can really be applied to the control or the conscious awareness of your use of sexual energy. This includes control or freedom from sexual thoughts, lust, and desire for sex, except in the context, they believe, of a spouse. Yogis observe this so that you can redirect and maintain and redirect that sexual energy. Because when it is saved, it is then transformed, and it can be transformed through practices into spiritual energy. The point's not just to make yourself miserable. The point is to use and harness that energy that you're giving away constantly in order to bring it inwards, bring it upwards through the spine, through the nadis, through the main channels, and then you have your enlightened experience. So you can take it as it will. I don't necessarily see that as abstinence, but I do see it as very mindful use of your sexual energy. There's so much we could say about that, and just about really how much is tied to you knowing who you are and your worth and the energy behind it. You know, when we engage in sexual activities with others, we form these energetic cords with them. You cannot avoid that. And that's where you leak energy. So just imagine having cords, not only to the sexual partners that you've had, but to everything that you own and everyone that you've, you know, had relationships with, and how much energy you'd be leaking. So really the goal is just to cut that off, bring it back, turn it back in. I'm not saying be a monk, but I am saying being very conscious of the way that you use your sexual energy. This applies to everyone, but especially I would say women. I don't want to get too much into like social media and Instagram, but like using your sexual energy consciously, that's all I'm going to say. I'm going to save those thoughts for another time. Okay. The fifth yama is aparigraha, and that means non-hoarding. So non-hoarding, non-coveting, it's like living a minimalistic life. So in the yoga tradition, possession of objects beyond those requisite for a living represents a form of hoarding. Keeping that which we don't need is hoarding. treat our life as though it was a computer hard drive and just delete everything unnecessary so that you can make room for what's truly needed. So, because I know, like, you know, you hear some of these and you're like, oh, non-stealing. Well, I don't take candy from the store. I don't hoard things, but it comes in many different forms and there's many different layers to it. So I really wanted to stress that. So non-hoarding really is like living minimalistically, and the true purpose is to know God, to find yourself, so you're not attached. It's the removal of attachments to the objects. And putting this in modern terms, yes, you can have things. Like, you don't need to live in an apartment with no furniture and just, you know, one soup bowl and a pillow, like that's it. No, like you're not a monk. If that's your path, that's great, and I really admire that, but it just was not my path. But it means you can have those things, but you're not attached to those things. So if something happened tomorrow and you lost everything, you'd be just as happy as you were today. A huge teaching on non-attachment is in the Bhagavad Gita. That's a whole different thing. There's different types of yoga in there. The one we're talking about right now is called Raja Yoga, which means the king of yoga, like the meditative practice, the more subtle practices. So that is all in the Gita. And like I said, I always recommend if you're just starting off, get a pocketbook and just sit with the words maybe like 5 minutes a day, because those scriptural texts are so deeply embedded with wisdom and truth that sometimes you'll have to read one sentence over and over and over again to really get it, or sit with it for a day or two. But the whole book is really on non-attachment. There's many other amazing lessons, but non-attachment, not only to your possessions, to relationships, to family. Like, very beginning, he's going to war. He has to kill his own relatives. And this is representative of those attachments. So, yeah, just read it for yourself. It's pretty epic. Okay, so now the second limb of yoga. So we just went through the restraints, and now we're going to go through the niyamas, or the ethical observances. So saucha means cleanliness. This is defined as purity. This is both internal and external cleanliness. This means clean clothes, clean body, clean place of residence. It's through saucha that we learn about the physical body, and thus ignorance is reduced. So in yoga, we have many different techniques to do that. There's kriyas, they cleanse the body. Bhakti yoga, which is really devotion to God, that cleanses the intellect, the mind. In the yogic way of thinking, the greatest impurity and the primary source of all suffering is avidya. And avidya means ignorance of the self. So when we're talking about internal cleanliness or energetic cleanliness, in the subtle body, asana and the pranayama, they purify the psychic channels in the body, or the nadis. These are similar to like acupuncture meridians, but they're different. There's tons of them. So they purify the nadis, which destroy the psychic debris that's created through our actions and our karmas and things like that. And even the ones that come in through our DNA or through our previous incarnations. So destroying these blocks, they increase the potential for yoga or divine union. Through saucha or cleanliness, the mind becomes fit for self-knowledge. So that's a really important one. Really, really important. I can't stand that yoga stereotype of like the guy who like hasn't showered in 5 days and he doesn't do his hair. And it's like, that's not saucha. Like, okay, maybe it's practicing, you know, non-attachment to your looks. I can see it, but I do want to say purity and cleanliness in body, mind, and spirit, that is saucha. Okay. So our second niyama is santosha, or contentment. Contentment is independent of external conditions. It's kind of like what I was talking about with if like there was a fire or you lost everything. It's contentment no matter what. It's good to aspire towards happiness and comfort, but in yoga, one must not be attached to these states. So true happiness does not exist on the outside, as we know. Rather, contentment comes from controlling the mind and remembering the laws of karma. So karma is a whole nother topic. Simply put, it's like, think of a boomerang. Whatever action you put out in the universe an equal and opposite reaction will come back. And you plant that seed. You're just planting seeds nonstop. So you come in with karma from past lives. Ideally, you're working towards clearing the slate or balancing the karma or neutralizing the karma. And you'll know that that's happened when it's instant. So if you like do something kind of shitty and then something comes right back to you, like, and I'm talking within like a minute or two, that's when the karma is neutralized. Like you're at 0 point, which is a great place to be. And then you from there really only want to add in good karmas. So we can cover that in another episode, but just to stick to the eight limb path, I'll continue there. So the third niyama is tapas, which means fire. It literally translates from Sanskrit to English as fire or enthusiasm or zealousness or heat. So heat, austerity, tapas is burning away the impurities through self-discipline. So tapas is like the passion or the fervor for any subject, sticking to it no matter what happens. Tapas is almost like a fever. So it's after experiencing tons of pain and suffering and disappointment in the physical world, which is inevitable, one realizes that it is imperative to seek out that which is eternal, because everything else is transient. Only your soul and your spirit is eternal. So the fourth niyama is svadhyaya, or self-study. Now, directly translated, it means study of scripture. So in yoga, we believe that concentrating the mind on holy texts like the Bhagavad Gita, the Dhammapada, the Yoga Sutras, Tao Te Ching, the Bible, and many more, they all remind us of our true nature. There's many, many, many texts. Whatever resonates with you, go with that. So self-study means study of the self, and that's the higher capital S self, not psychoanalysis like we do in the West. That only brings more attention to the ego personality or the small self. So it's about reflecting constantly on what is real and what is not real, what is eternal and what is transient. It is through studying the scriptures that we can really quickly gain these insights when we're ready and these guidelines towards self-realization. So it really just speeds up your path and your progress. And the last niyama is called Ishvara Pranidhana, which means surrender to the Lord or surrender to God. So this is the essence of yoga and the goal of all spiritual aspirants. It is only in total faith that we have a complete loss of fear. Before performing any action in yoga, we believe, offer it up to God. In this way, we free ourselves from selfish action. I know that God sometimes can be a harder concept for people, so you can choose how you want to see this. Source energy, creator energy, the universe, your higher self, your soul, like whatever speaks to you. It's about making an offering up to something greater than your personality self. So in this way, we're able to free ourselves from selfish action. Devotion to God or the source or universe, universal energy, your higher self, it is the total surrender of the ego. Once you have knowledge of the self, then you realize that everything is God for the universe. Then you're able to surrender the ego in order to achieve enlightenment. So it's really, you do all of the above, yamas and niyamas, and then that one, that last one, Ishvara Pranidhana, like that's the last step. It's really just giving it all up, like surrendering to God, to the ultimate divine plan. So those are our guidelines to how to live our life. And now we're going to move into practices that get more and more subtle as to how to really work towards enlightenment. But remember, those are the foundation. You build your house without a solid foundation, it's ultimately going to crumble. So the third limb of the eight-limbed path is asana, and that's the postures. We all know that, you know, you think of like whatever you see on a commercial, some girl in Warrior 2, like, yes, technically that's yoga. That is the asana practice or the posture practice. Ultimately, the asana practice is only there and has only been developed in order to keep the body physically clean, to remove energetic blockages, and so that you can sit in meditation. Literally, that's it. The purpose of the asana practice is so you can sit comfortably in meditation for longer periods of time. That's it. So really think about that when you go to take a yoga class or when you do your practice at home and see if that's kind of the goal or if that's what it feels like the class is moving towards. So that's traditionally what the asana practice is for. It's morphed and changed a little bit now in the West, but there you have it. So now we're going to go to the fourth limb, which is pranayama. And like I said earlier, that's the bridge. That is the bridge between the physical and the metaphysical. And that is when we start working with the breath. So prana, the word prana means life energy. And so prana is the energy that keeps us alive. It's similar to in Chinese medicine, qi, or in Reiki or Japanese thought, ki, or like there's so many different systems that call it different things, but it's really that life force energy. So it's vitality, or it's a cosmic vibration. It's the energy permeating the universe at all levels, physical, mental, intellectual, sexual, spiritual, and cosmic. Prana is a subtle vibration, and due to prana, everything is able to exist and move, including thoughts, names, and forms. And by that means how we operate in the world. Like we're born and we learn, this is a book, this is a bear, this is a apple. Everything has a thought, you know, we put a thought to it and give it a name and a label and a form, and then ultimately really the work is undoing that. But prana exists in even those things. So it is a term used in regards to the all-pervasive life force used to describe a specific current of life energy in the human body. So the main goal of pranayama is to control the prana, or control the energy through our breath. And ideally, you bring it up the central channel, the central psychic channel, or it's called the Shushumna Nadi, one of the main central psychic channels. This is when you hear of people talking about their kundalini rising. This is where it goes. So it's from the base of the spine up all the way. You move it through all the seven energy centers or chakras, and then eventually divine union is attained once it reaches the top, or your kundalini is awakened, however you want to call it, but that's bliss, enlightenment. The goal of pranayama is not only health of the body and clearing these nadis, but also it's to move that energy up and to reach enlightenment. So like I said, prana means energy, yama means control. And so pranayama can be translated as control of the breath or an expansion of life force energy. So it involves taking conscious control over the inhalation, the retention of the inhalation, and then the exhalation, and then the retention of the exhalations. There's four parts to your breath, four parts to the breathing. There's the inhale, there's the top of the inhale or the hold, the natural pause that occurs. Then there's the exhale, the descent, and then there's the natural pause at the bottom. And it's really, we work with those four parts of the breath in many different ways when we work with pranayama. So through the practice of pranayama, we harness and direct the energy, the prana, in order to restore and maintain optimal health. I also will say that back in ancient times, yogis would prescribe different pranayama practices and mantras in order to bring people back to health, or if they're not sick, into their spirituality. So you would go see your guru and they would give you certain pranayama practices to do in order to bring your state back into its natural health, and also mantras. And mantra work, it's really beautiful. I know that now there's like, you know, different songs and people have changed things a lot. And just even the vibration of the words is going to have a positive effect in your life. But traditionally, mantras were meant to be said and spoken in a certain way, in a certain rhythm, with a certain tonality and melody to them, because that is what moved the brain state into a particular frequency so that meditative states could occur. So really in yoga, when you're chanting these mantras, I personally like to stick as close to the traditional chants as possible, because I feel that's really where the magic is. It's already written for you. Everything is handed to you. Like, why mess with something that's already proven to work? So that being said, so the respiratory system serves as a bridge between the conscious and the subconscious mind. And there's an integral relationship between the state of mind that you have and your breath. This is very obvious. So when one's really quiet and calm, you know, like you'll typically, if you just finally got home from work and off the subway and you get in and you relax your shoulders, that's a sigh of relief. And if you're agitated or you're fearful or something scary's happened, you know, that is a different type of breath. And so you'll notice that your mood will affect your breathing. You feel relaxed, or your external environment feels relaxed, you relax. Your external environment or the stimuli in front of you create panic, then your breath is affected by that. But in yoga, we try to flip the script. So instead of being at whim to our environment and everything around us, we're saying, no, now we're going to control our breath, and we're going to start to harness and shift the way our mind works through these practices instead of the mind controlling us. One of my favorite quotes ever from a Baiji, which is a female Mahatma in some traditions in India, was, "Make mind your slave." Those are exact words. And I love that, because that's exactly what we're really trying to do. I know, you know, a lot of people now, it's like everything in PC culture is like, just love this and love that and be friend. No, it's like in yoga, no, it's like you train your mind so it doesn't run you. It's not a friendship here. Like, you run that show. That's the goal. So pranayama is just a means towards that. And also, I didn't mention this, but asana, the posture practice, is as well. It's the same exact thing that I just said with the breathing, but except with posture. Like, you're feeling sad and something happened, or you're feeling afraid, you're probably going to hunch your shoulders round forward, head down, and your posture is reflecting your mood. And it's reverse, you know, you're feeling really confident, you just got a promotion, things went really well for you at work, whatever. You're walking in, your shoulders are back, your chest is lifted, your head is up. Your posture is reflective of your mood. And so the asana practice flips the script, and it's like, okay, even if I feel a certain way internally, I'm going to put myself into these physical postures, hold them for a duration of time with conscious awareness and breath. And then through that, and through the repetition of that, now I can start to change my mental state. And ideally, then that's going to get me calm enough to sit and meditate, which takes some time. So that's what we're trying to do here with these posture practices and this breath work. It's to move us into the more subtle frequencies, the higher dimensions, or the more subtle vibrations, so that we can find a comfortable seat in meditation. So that is what pranayama is. There's a lot more to it. And like I said, I'm trying to condense this into a shorter time so that we can really get through the whole system. But yeah, if you're interested in learning more about this, I do mentorships for yoga teachers where we really go over stuff like this, as well as private yoga and meditation lessons online. So that's available if you're interested in learning more of these particular practices that would be suited best for your constitution. So the fifth limb is called pratyahara, which is withdrawal of the senses. I always literally think of a turtle pulling all of his arms, his tail, his legs, his head into his shell. That is pratyahara. It's freeing the mind from the nervous system. It's the natural outgrowth from regular practice of the asana and the pranayama. This is what happens. You shift your awareness from the outer world to your inner world. So a huge part of this withdrawal of the senses is consciously practicing relaxation. In yoga, we call it yoga nidra, which is a guided body scan. That's actually what I send to you guys if you leave a review. It's a 15-minute guided relaxation body scan. And this is very helpful for people that are trying to rewire their brain from trauma, especially a lot of physical trauma and sexual trauma and things like that. So outside of just the yoga tradition, it's like, just body scanning is used by physios everywhere, but it comes from the yoga tradition. Yoga nidra just means yogic sleep or psychic sleep. And it's when you bring yourself to a altered state of mind without really trying. You're just consciously relaxing the body in certain areas here and there. And it is so important. It is said that a proper 10 minutes of yoga nidra is equal to that of 4 hours of deep sleep. I can attest to this from my own personal experience, knowing that yoga nidra was one of the really main practices that helped me move away from when I was going through very serious panic and PTSD symptoms. yoga nidra, certain pranayama practices, not all, because not all of them are meant to calm you down. And meditation was such a huge part of that. So yoga nidra is one of the main components there. And I really love it so much. I'm actually leading a training in that in January, so quite soon, in New York. So if you're interested in that, you could find that on my website. It's really spoken to me. It's helped me work with my nervous system and retrain it to the point where you can really, the way I like to describe it is, I won't get too much into the brainwave states, but delta would be sleeping or unconscious rest, and high beta is typically where, you know, a very stressed out individual functions, gamma, beta. And what we really want to maintain when we're doing these yogic practices is moving our mind into these alpha states or these more restful states, and then eventually theta states, where really deep healing can occur. And then, you know, enlightenment is moving into delta, but you're not unconscious anymore. You're conscious of it. And then you're one with everything. So yoga nidra and pratyahara, pratyahara being the fifth limb, is one of the main components to that. It's one of my favorite things in the world. And the easy way to remember that is just like think of a turtle pulling everything in. So that is pratyahara. So the sixth limb is dharana. And that is concentration or one-pointed focus. This means that there's no sensory disturbances, no restless outward thoughts. In yoga, you are practicing, like I said earlier, on training the mind. Not really necessarily listening to it, but you are training your mind to concentrate on one thing. That's what dharana is. And there's different practices. So they do things called japa practice, which is similar to almost like rosary beads, but you use mala beads. You probably see yoga people wearing them. Really, these are items that are supposed to be used to enhance your spiritual practice. And so in India, you never wear that on your wrist or your feet or put them on the floor. They're like rosary beads almost in a way. And so in japa meditation, you usually have a mantra and you can just start with the mantra Om, and you do it 108 times, or you follow the beads. For each bead that you hold, you repeat the mantra. That's a form of dharana or one-pointed focus. You can do candle gazing. It's called Trataka. And there's many different types of yogic practices. When you take a class and you're like, oh, I'm interested in incorporating more of this into my life, how do I do that? It's your gaze. Where are you looking when you're in a pose? We call that drishti, or it's just an external gaze when you're practicing the asana practice or the yoga practice. But you can do that now when you're in a class. Are you looking at the person next to you? Are you looking at the walls? Are you looking at the teacher? Or are you looking at your own fingers? Or do you have a soft gaze somewhere and your concentration is inwards, not outwards? So this is all, like, this can be applied in class, outside of class, you know, at home. But dharana is that one-pointed focus of the mind. So you're training your mind to listen to you and to focus and to concentrate on one thing. And that is so much easier said than done. So the seventh limb is now, it's called dhyana. And that is now when you are in a state of meditation. I want to stress that dhyana is not quote unquote meditating. Dhyana is the state that occurs through dharana or through a concentrated mental state. So it's when you become absorbed into and identified with the object of your concentration. So dharana is like you're still, there's effort, there's tapas, there's zeal, like you're trying, you're doing your best to remain focused, to train your mind. Dhyana is the state that happens through the fruits of those actions. That is when you move into it. And you've all had this. If you meditate, or even this can happen, like if you take a yoga class and you're so blissed out, and then the teacher asks you to sit for a few minutes after, and it feels like a second went by, that's when you're in meditation. The time warp, like that's when you're in it. And it's when like hours can feel like a few minutes because you're truly immersed in that cosmic state. So that is dhyana. That is the seventh limb of yoga. And lastly, the eighth limb is samadhi. And that means bliss, nirvana, state of oneness. It's enlightenment. It's ultimately enlightenment. It's complete absorption. It's the super conscious union of the soul with the divine. It's a perception of oneness with the entire universe. That's the goal. Merging with the higher self, merging with God, merging with whatever you want to say, source consciousness, universe. It's the union of those two, with you, who you are in this earth body, in this human form, and God or the divine. That's the goal of yoga. And the eight limbs, which we just went over, that is the ascending path towards that goal. So I know that was a lot of information in a very short amount of time, and there was a lot of Sanskrit there, but again, all of that's going to be in the notes. If you'd like to learn more about this stuff, I would definitely recommend reading the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali, the Bhagavad Gita. There's, let's see, I'm just looking at my bookshelf here, the Garuda Samhita, the Ramayana, Light on Yoga. And also, we're going to list a few of these books on the podcast website. So if you go to soulawakeningpodcast.com and you go to the free gifts tab, we have a reading list, and a lot of that is there. Another good book, which is super amazing, is Autobiography of a Yogi. That book is really cool. It really talks about Yogananda, who is an enlightened yogi, and his journey coming from India to bringing this yoga practice into the West. And The Golden Present is also one of my favorite books. And it's a really sweet day-by-day guidance. And this one is by Swami Satchitananda. And there's also just plenty of information out there you can read online. But like I said, the whole point of this podcast was just to show you a path. This is a path that's pretty tried and true. I will say it's definitely not easy. I want to really state that it's not easy, but what you receive from it, the bliss that you gain from it, even if it's small in the beginning, you keep that forever. And it's something that is very near and dear to my heart, because for me, yoga was, and by yoga, as you know now, I mean this eight-limb system, was that shining beacon of light that helped really light up my path and move me into the path of raising my vibration, raising my frequency, and moving me towards this work and moving me towards ascension. That's my personal journey. It's something you can do until very old age. It works. I've met many enlightened souls, and just literally being in their presence, even if it's online through the computer, will raise your frequency. And they follow the path of yoga. They follow this eight-limb path towards ultimately enlightenment. And so it exists. It's real. I know a big question that I used to have when I first really started on this path was like, are there really enlightened human beings on this planet right now? And I want to say, yes, there's a bunch. There's many. And I also would really ask the question, is it possible then for us to become enlightened if we're not taking the path of a renunciate, of a monk or Mahatma or Swami? And the answer to that is yes, it is possible as well. It's definitely harder, I think. I mean, both paths are completely different, but it is possible. It just, you know, we're really in the thick of it. We're in the thick of the matrix trying to work through it. And so sometimes navigating that, we have to really work a little bit harder through certain obstacles, but they also have their own. So, yes, I hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to reach out and let me know if this clarified some things for you with the yoga practice, or if this interested you in the yoga practice or got you on the way with it, or if you loved any of the books that you heard from the podcast. So thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, definitely subscribe to the podcast. You'll be notified of all of our new podcasts and episodes that come out. And if you loved the information that you heard today, or you know somebody that you think could benefit from hearing about this kind of path, or maybe they just get some more clarity on what it is you do if you're a yoga teacher, or, you know, a really avid yoga practitioner, then share it with them. And hopefully this will bring some more clarity into the relationship. So in the yoga tradition, we always start and seal off our classes with namaste. And namaste means the light in me sees and honors the light in you. So to seal off the episode, I'm your host, Kat Fowler, and I'm wishing you peace, love, light, and joy for the rest of your day. And I'll see you on the next episode. Namaste.